This is Backstory, the show that looks to the American past to understand the times we're living through today. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Bella. Today, we're talking about the history of financial crises in the U.S. And as always, we're taking your phone calls.
Next up, we have Carol calling from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Carol, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's great to have you on the show talking about financial panics. What's panicking you today?
Well, the question I was going to pose to you guys was about the panic of 1819, really the nation's first big panic, and also the role that Andrew Jackson played in resolving that or not resolving it.
Right.
Great question. I'm going out to check my 401k, Peter.
Okay. We'll let you know when you can come back. It'll be about a century from now.
Okay.
Carol wants to know about the panic of 1819 and
who doesn't?
Old Hickory had to do with it. Let me start, Carol, by suggesting that the panic of 1819 was based on massive real estate speculation on a very popular Democratic level, and the banking system simply couldn't handle it. The Second Bank of the United States was badly implicated in the credit contraction that led to lots of bankruptcies and people losing their land and unable to pay the government for their land out west. And it rippled to all parts of the country, except for New England was generally immune to this because they had a much more responsible, locally based banking system. But that folk memory of the failure of the banks became the issue that galvanized Andrew Jackson's presidency. Now, nobody knew that he was hostile to the rechartering of the Second Bank of the U.S., but this became the issue he seized on. And I think most historians would agree that Jackson's war with Nicholas Biddle at the Second Bank, which led to its failure to recharter, led to a period of financial and fiscal havoc in the U.S. that exacerbated the business cycle and led to massive financial dislocations. So you're looking for a fall guy, Carol. I think Andrew Jackson's your man.
How about those state banks, though, Peter? Did they
hurt? Oh, no. Listen, the state banks led to a vast, vast expansion in liquidity. And in good times, that's great because everybody's on board. It's a rising tide. And everybody's getting rich. But then when the tide turns—
So were they the kind of the subprime lenders of their day?
Brian, I think that's perfect. I mean, the U.S. government, in effect, was lending to people who just didn't have pockets deep enough to handle it. But nobody could tell that. Everybody's got to learn this lesson over and over again. That's what we historians, we're very smug about this, but we see it all.
And live it again.
Yeah, right.
Carol, why are you interested in 1819, if you don't mind me asking? Do you still owe money from them?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, you could almost write the script that we're going through now with 1819. And, you know, I mean, it's almost the exact same story a second time around.
So were there lessons that we should have learned from 1819 and Andrew Jackson that we've not, Carol?
You know, I think bank regulation, I think, is a really big one, that when we had very few regulations, we did lurch from panic to panic, and when people are given the opportunity to, you know, do bad things, they do. And as much as we may or may not like having government, that it seems to play an important role in keeping the system working.
That's a great point, Carol. But this is a lot different from Jackson's war on the bank, because then the analysis of many Jacksonian Democrats is that too much government was the problem and that the federal government should not be involved with banking because that created this speculative enterprise at the highest level that put everybody at risk. That's the way they looked at it.
But when you didn't have a central bank to be managing the economy, then you also had problems.
Question about it. I'm just saying that the populist Democratic answer was get government off our backs. That's not the way we're thinking now.
I have a bold conclusion.
Yeah, conclude boldly.
You always either have too much or not enough government intervention.
That is, man, that's verging on profound.
And that you don't know until afterwards which one was right.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's why you need historians.
Exactly.
When it's too late, we're ready to weigh in.
Yeah. But Carol, did this call work for you? I mean, are you feeling better about the financial situation?
No.
You're a smart person, okay. Carol.
It cut her off. Carol, thanks for calling.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye.
My papa stole a chicken. My mama fried it hard. The reason why she did that, he couldn't steal no lard. Depression blues. Oh, I hate depression blues. Depression blues. Oh, I hate depression blues.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about financial panics throughout American history. And we want to know what you want to know. Drop us a question or a comment at backstoryradio.org. Just click Join the Discussion. Peter, who's up next?
It's David in Omaha, Nebraska. David, welcome to Backstory.
Hi, thank you.
We're talking about panics today. You got any hot tips or news for us?
Well, I have been wondering. I spend a lot of time in front of the computer and paying attention to, you know, the financial stuff that's going on now.
Right.
And we get our news really fast. And so I was wondering if that has, you know, like in the 1800s, you know, I imagine they had to wait around for the newspaper for a lot of their news. And I'm wondering if that possibly has influenced the way that they reacted to their banking situations.
What a great question.
Terrific question.
I look forward to hearing Peter's answer.
Well, it's all about information, and I think you got your finger right on it. Many economists say that the market is nothing more than a system for circulating information. Early American newspapers basically existed to publish prices current in different places so that people could make long-distance mercantile calculations. So the time lapse in getting that information, which is crucial for making decisions about production, just imagine trying to gear your tobacco crop for a market that you can only barely anticipate a year or two in advance. The difference between the way colonial people operate in the Atlantic economy and the way Walmart now operates couldn't be starker. And I think you've really focused on a truly important issue, and that is the speed of communication.
And how did the telegraph and wire services change all this, guys?
Well, I'm a huge fan of the telegraph as explaining a lot in American history. And one of the things that I think that we don't really realize, it was a bigger change in the internet in its own time. Yeah. I mean, internet's basing on already a system of mass and instant communication called, you know, the telephone. But the telegraph, it was just a huge break with everything that had come before. And like the early newspapers, it was used first to convey prices and vote returns very rapidly. So the panic of 1857, which would have been the first real panic that the telegraph would have played a role, it both accelerated its coming and maybe accelerated its resolution.
That's okay for information. So I think we've answered some of David's questions. But David, would you agree with me that another real break is the move from simple information to actually flows of capital, which today can fly around the globe in no time at all?
Yeah, that was something I had a question about as well.
I want you to have the answer, David, not a question.
Well, it sounds pretty reasonable to me. We hear a lot about how quickly we're moving, you know, billions of dollars worth of commercial paper every day.
Right.
It seems like that system would have been a lot slower in the past.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, the trick is that in good times, all that speed removes all kinds of inefficiencies from business and allows really unprecedented rates of growth and integration. What we're seeing right now is the flip side of that, is how there's no insulation of time or distance from a crisis in one part of the system to a crisis in the whole system. So, you know, it's the same thing that made us so rich so fast is now depleting. Last number I heard, $29 trillion in wealth destruction in just a few weeks. So
yeah,
and without that speed of communication, you certainly couldn't have had
that. And I agree absolutely with that. And, you know, maybe one of the best ways of measuring this, David, is to look at our regulatory structures, which, you know, even going back to the 30s, when a lot of this was put in place, we could conceive of separate regulatory structures for the savings and loans. In fact, Glass-Steagall separates out investment and commercial banking. We could have a separate regulatory structure for the stock exchange, the SEC. And today, all of the calls are for one macro regulatory mechanism, precisely because the speed at which people can move investments within all of these venues is so fast. And you really need a body that's looking at those flows on not only a day-to-day basis, I mean an hour-to-hour basis. And I'm sure one of the changes that you're very aware of is, you know, the 24/7 cycle in business itself with Asian markets and European markets. I mean, it never stops. And I would predict that we're over the next 15 or 20 years going to see a growth in international institutions. And I know that a lot of Americans are going to object to that. But a lot of states objected to national regulation in the late 19th century.
Right. So you see the scope of national government expanding in the future and of an international regimes of various sorts regulating the global economy?
Yeah. And I think we're indebted to David because I think he's put his finger on one of the key insights that historians might have about what's going on right now, which is when the scope of economic transactions and the pace of those economic transactions, the transparency of them, and the speed increase, there's eventually going to be a corresponding change in the political institutions that promote these exchanges and that oversee these exchanges. And we watched them break through the state barriers in the 19th century. And I think we're going to watch them break through the nation barriers in the 21st century.
David, thanks for calling.
Thank you, David.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Well, guys, as much as I do like looking into the crystal ball, we know that historians are notoriously bad at predicting the future. So let's stick with the past and see if we can't draw any conclusions about these financial crises that seem to recur time and again, a fixture of American history.
That's a good idea, Brian. And if we think about then, what's the continuity across all these things? I've heard several.
Right.
One, they come with remarkable regularity and yet are a surprise every time. Second, they are ever-growing scope. So as awesome as 1819 was, 37 was bigger, and then 73 is bigger than that, and 93 is bigger than that, and 29 is bigger than that, right?
And because we go global.
Exactly.
I think that's great, and I agree with that. I just think there's another narrative that could be told on the level of subjectivity that is how people experience these dislocations.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways it goes from macro to micro. In the 20th century, or even in the 21st century, the one we're unfortunately living in now, we got a lot of collective memory about previous economic dislocations. We have a lot of experience with it. And we know who to blame. Now, we may be overgeneralizing, we may miss the mark, but what we're really talking about is a worldwide failure of public and private institutions. Policies have failed and people are responsible and bankers are exploiting us. But who's responsible for 1819?
That's a question that our listeners have been puzzling over, I'm sure.
Think about it, listeners. I think in the 1819, when the bottom falls out of the real estate market, when there's deflation, when credit is called in, and there's only this Bank of the United States, and it's really pursuing the interests of shareholders – and seems to be exacerbating the problem of the sudden loss of credit and liquidity and currency. I think people look at that, and you want to know why there are end-of-the-world scenarios, apocalyptic visions. Why would people think this way? It's because the sheer scale of dislocation, it's those experiences of things you can't do anything about and you don't understand. That's like God is doing this, right?
Yeah.
And I think that is sheer panic.
Sheer
man.
Panic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pure panic.
No, that's a terrific point.
Yeah.
So let me just see if I can understand what you're saying, Peter, is that because today we expect that we can do something about these dislocations, that it's not as pure a panic as the days when this truly was the end of the world and there wasn't much we could do about it except pray.
Right, exactly right. And I think in some ways we're more comfortable with the financial wreckage of the world right now than our predecessors would have been a century
ago. Yeah, we don't
ago.
Think it's God's judgment. Yeah. But you know what? That's a good point, but this is not a linear progression in the sense that mid-19th century, what we think of as the Victorian era, was more religious than 1819,
yeah.
I think.
That's right.
And we can really find the time when people first really translated this concern into religious language is 1857, which is mm-hmm. often forgotten by people, I think. It was called the Businessman's Revival, and people really started going to church explicitly because they just lost their shirts and admitted that they had lost their way, they got greedy and all this sort of stuff. And many of foreshadowings of things that you're going to see in the 20th century actually happened in 1857.
Well, I think you make a good point about religion, Ed. I like that a lot. But I would say that in earlier periods, people would think about national sin and collective responsibility, that judgments were rendered on whole communities. And your businessmen in 1857, they're wondering if they got right with Christ, maybe they wouldn't have had these problems.
So as we move into the 20th century, and in fact today, it's a sense, well, somehow we're not spending enough or we were profligate with our credit cards. It's a kind of psychologized panic.
Yeah.
And that is one of the continuities. We always think that if we just do the right thing, if we're God-fearing enough, or if the nation is God-fearing enough, or if we've got the right combination of experts in public policy, we're going to avoid this.
Yeah.
And so we always end up with that soul searching.
What you're really going to do is listen to Backstory with the American History Guys, and then you'll be ready for the next one. I don't think we can help you this time around, folks, but next time, play this on your iTunes iPod.
If you still have one.
The hamster-driven model.
That's it for today's show. Remember, the hour may be up, but the conversation continues online. You can find us at backstoryradio.org, and you can weigh in on our upcoming show topics there and sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter.
It's all at backstoryradio.org. Don't be a stranger.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Rachel Quimby, and Catherine Moore, with help from Lydia Wilson.
Jamal Milner mixed the show, and Gabby Alter wrote our theme. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Wyndham.
Major production support for Backstory with the American History Guys is provided by the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, the Perry Foundation, Incorporated, Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation, and an anonymous donor.
Support also comes from Marcus and Carol Weinstein, Trish and David Crow, Claire Gargalli and David Carley, J.M. Weinberg, and Caroline Feeney.
If I ever get a job again, I will never be a snob again. I'm through with stocks and bonds, I'd rather spend it all on blondes. If I ever get a job again, if I ever get my pay again.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Wyndham for VFH Radio at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.
If I ever get a job again, with my old friends I'll hobnob again. What great fun it will be, saying just have one more on me.